Hello, I'm Dan Yergin, Vice Chairman of IHS Market, and I want to welcome you to a CERAWeek conversation presented by IHS Market with Ryan Lance, who's the Chairman and CEO of ConocoPhillips. Ryan, very glad to have you with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dan. Appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, as always.
Good. Well, there's a lot to talk about, and I think we should start talking really with the impact of the COVID-19 on ConocoPhillips organization and how your people have responded.
Well, thanks, Dan. Appreciate the opportunity again to visit with you and share a bit of perspectives. And on COVID, it's interesting. I had an update this morning with my team. We exercised a crisis management team early in the process to work with our global workforce. We've had 13 cases globally. Happy to report none of those came from the workplace. They were all contracted in their homes or with spouses or on vacation. Everybody's recovered or recovering, which is great. Here in Houston, Bartlesville, Oklahoma, where we have our back office, we're about ready to go into what we call phase two of our office reopening, which will be about 50% of our workforce that will work in an A and B schedule or a blue-red schedule. Half the workforce will come in 1 week and then the next week the other half, so we can get everybody reacclimated to coming back into the office environment. But I will give a huge shout out to the organization. They've done an incredible job keeping the operations running safely, delivering all the oil back into the market that we can as a company. And it's been remarkable what people have gone through and just sort of this distance meetings, these Zoom meetings or Microsoft Teams, whatever kind of software you use, have been remarkable to kind of keep everything together and keep the employees engaged and operating. Maybe one interesting factoid, our China office is back to full capacity as of a week ago as well. So they're certainly out ahead in some areas in our company, primarily in South America, in the Middle East, are a little bit behind what's happening in Europe and in the U.S. But everything's progressing. So
you mentioned your China office, and I know that you obviously made you aware of the epidemic earlier than other people. Kind of what was your kind of first reaction?
You know, we came up with a protocol that basically at the time said there was about a 14-day incubation period for the virus. So we'd send people offshore and have them work for 14 days. And then the next crew coming in would have to self-quarantine and isolate for 14 days. So really helped us work through the operational protocol that then was applied to the North Slope of Alaska, where we had 4,000 workers, and to our offshore operations in Norway and elsewhere around the whole world. So it helped us get a jump start to figure out what the proper protocols were to make sure that our offshore, where we can't socially distance really well, you know, we had to develop the mask protocol and some of those other things, but really helped us get a jump start on that. And I think helped us keep our cases down to a minimum.
Are there any big learnings that you've taken away from this about your organization and how it operates and will operate in the future?
We do have protocols. We are thermally scanning people for their temperature before they come in to try to identify people that may not know that they have the virus. So we're doing a lot of that protocols to get there. But yeah, it really, you have to think about all those places where social distancing is not a natural and what kind of congestion that creates for your workplace. So yeah, we're learning a lot.
So the big question that's in many people's minds, the future of the office, have you guys figured out yet what you think is going to be between people working at home and people working in the office?
Well, I think, you know, we're going to have to. What I've told the workforce, is it's time to come back into the office, but we need to relook at kind of our longer term plans with respect to work from home and some of those benefits. We already had that as a benefit for the company. I would say, you know, many people maybe thought it was socially or not really acceptable to go do that. So we're going to have to rethink longer term what this means for our company as well. And I think all of industry is going to be doing the same thing. But what we do notice, though, is that, you know, some productivity is lacking by doing this. The innovation comes down. The collaboration is naturally impacted by just having these kinds of engagements. So there is some value, a lot of value, to getting those teams back together and being able to work in a space together that allows you to collaborate a bit more effectively and do innovation. But, you know, this is certainly going to you know, satellite offices, real estate offices, and some of that, there's the opportunity to rethink how you do business. And we'll do that too. We'll step back when this is all done and say, what did we learn from it and what should we be doing differently?
I guess if we think about it, the first surprise for people was to really find out how productive you could be by being connected to Zoom and everything.
But yeah, I think this whole, you know, you're 50% less productive working from home, I don't think people saw that. And I think the real benefit that I hear from the workforce is the ability to get away from the commute. You know, the commute in the big cities like Houston and other places ends up taking maybe an hour, hour and a half of your day. Then now you can either spend more time with the family or spend more time with the company. So it is this issue of the commute that I think is an important one that we have to consider as we think about this going forward.
Well, with many people at home and people in the field and so forth, you made some big decisions about curtailment driven by the market and maybe kind of what your process of thought was and how it's evolved as the market has rebounded from minus 37 to plus 37.
Yeah, I think we saw even, I'd have to say, I know you've seen a lot in this oil and gas business, Dan, over your career, but I think negative prices and a global pandemic are two things that none of us had saw.
And even with your scenarios.
Yeah, even with all the scenarios that you run. So having a four sigma or double black swan event like we've seen in our industry. Yeah, you know, when we saw that and we saw the futures curve, we saw the things happening on the production side, you know, we made a decision pretty early on to start curtailing our production. And we were getting, you know, single digit kinds of offers at the wellhead for some of the product that we were producing. And we just didn't feel like that was sufficient. Now it covered costs, but we kind of viewed this as a quasi investment decision. So, you know, the amount that you shut in is your investment, and then you're going to recover that over time at what you think might be higher prices. So we had to get with our commercial team, our chief economist's office, our operating staff, figure out how much we could kind of come down in production. And then what did we have a view on a monthly basis going forward as to the price recovery? And we made a decision pretty early on to start curtailing production as far back as April and May. And right now, if you were to look into our May production and our June production, we've got about a third of our production shut in as a company, you know, 400,000 barrels a day. But we see some strengthening in the market. So we are in the process of thinking about how do we, under what circumstances do we start coming back into the market and then start selling our product? And of course, that's everybody is probably in this space when you see the forward curve or the index is sitting above $30 a barrel. I'm sure everybody's having this conversation. So we do have to be worried about a double bump in this process, depending on what the OPEC plus countries do. But you know, our view is there's quite a bit of production shut in right now to try to balance the market in the US and keep inventories at a reasonable level. We saw draws for a while, now we saw a little bit of a build. So it gives us some sense that people are coming back into the market, which starts to impact our thinking as well. But I would say we're probably thinking of slowly coming back into the market over the next few months and reducing the amount we've got curtailed because we're seeing some strengthening in the price.
So you have a balance sheet that allows you to have that flexibility. I guess for those who don't have the same balance sheet, there'll be maybe more of a rush back to the market when there's...
Yeah, and I think that's what we worry about, again, having a double peak or a double trough, whatever you want to describe it. And yeah, we're fortunate we came into this downturn with a pretty significant comfort on the balance sheet. We had $8 billion of cash, we have a $6 billion revolver. So we've got a very strong relative competitive position, and we're going to maintain that as we go through this. So, but that, to your point, has allowed us to make some decisions on curtailments that maybe others can't do. If they're making a dollar at the wellhead for their crude, then they're willing to sell that because they can't forego that cash flow as easily as we can because of the strength of that balance sheet. So we would expect as we see these price signals coming with the markers above 30 that people are gonna start producing. In fact, we talked to our private equity friends, even some of the public companies. We probably won't know until second quarter results are announced or even third quarter what this is going to be. Not everybody's being completely transparent with that. And I would expect that as we watch the market, production is coming back. And I'm sure OPEC and OPEC Plus are watching that too, just trying to figure out, you know, what kind of price target do they want and what's happening with the global inventories.
I think, my guess is they're watching it very carefully now because, of course, that was the important part of the rebalancing in the market that we've seen. You know, horizontal wells shale is really probably only a little more than a decade old. What do we know about when you shut in a shale well, a horizontal well, about bringing it back and what the impact is, and is there much cost to that?
We don't think so, Dan. We've had some experience. You know, you get plant turnarounds that you have to go do. 2 years ago, we had to shut in for about 20 days just due to Hurricane Harvey that was coming through the Upper Texas Gulf Coast. So we have some experience, and then of course as we do well maintenance on our wells, we've got experience with what flush production looks like in these unconventionals. And we got experience about how to bring back the operations. So in our experience, there's a little bit of extra cost associated with it, but not a lot. And the experience is there is flush production in these unconventionals that come back. And then if you have spare capacity, facility capacity at the surface to handle that flush production, then it is a very rational economic decision to do the kind of curtailment. As long as you have the balance sheet and the capacity to forego that cash flow, it's a very rational decision when you have a declining profile like an unconventional well. And as you shut it in, the pressure in the reservoir is still equilibrating around the wellbore such that when you open it back up, you do see flush production come back. Now, it takes a period of years to produce all of that volume, which is why it becomes just a quasi-investment decision and a rate of return calculation that you want to do depending on your view of future forward curve prices.
Yeah. And presumably, I mean, do you think the same would have, do we know enough if one was shut in for 4 or 5 months, whether it would be the same sort of profile?
Yeah, we have some experience with that as well. And it's the same profile. You get the flush production back and it takes time to, produce all those deferred barrels, but presumably you're producing them in a much higher commodity price. The other thing I'd say, Dan, is you can't just look at the index price that you see on your terminal and look at WTI. It really is what's the net back. And there's there's transportation built into that. There's, calendar month averages as you go through the marketing months associated with marketing your volumes. So there are a lot of moving pieces in that. And it's really the net back wellhead price that you got to pay attention to, which in some cases can get quite disconnected from that marker price. Ergo what happened in April when we saw, negative prices. So that's when traders, face the decision, do I take the physical possession of those physical barrels, even if I don't have storage capacity? And a lot of them didn't have storage capacity, couldn't take the physical barrels, so they had to pay somebody to take them off their hands.
Yes. So, yeah, that's right. So, obviously, the futures price or the screen price can mislead because so much of that reflects expectations and financial players.
Yeah. But certainly these curtailments are absolutely necessary. There's just no way we could have responded to this kind of a drop in demand that we've seen as everybody sheltered in place to prevent the spread of this COVID-19 pandemic, and just unheard of the demand reduction that occurred in the second quarter. And this was the only way that we could have dealt with that had that global cooperation, the U.S. companies doing what we've done on curtailments, combined with what, supply has been shut down around the world.
Yeah. And, this is not like any other cycle. This is
none like I've ever seen.
Yeah. or that the industry's ever seen, actually.
Yeah.
Let's then turn to what does this mean for shale's role? Shale has been the most dynamic factor in the oil market for almost a decade. We've been in the shale era. U.S. in February, ironically, reached the highest point ever in U.S. oil production, 13 million barrels a day.
Yep.
What do you think happens to shale over the next year or two?
Well, I think, in our business, we've always seen when we've gone through these downturns, it does take supply longer to come back than as fast as we shut it in. So that's just a natural outcome. And I think there's a couple other factors at play that will dictate the speed of the recovery. I don't think shale's gone. I don't think anybody says that. There's going to be some very low cost to supply shale resources that still exist in the United States. We have a lot of that in our own company as well, reserves and resource that we will come back to putting rigs back to work, putting frac spreads back to work, and investing in growth again in the shale. So it will come back. I think there is probably a couple of factors at work. Certainly the the investing community has lost money in energy in the last decade. So I think the value proposition that you present, how much you're returning back to the shareholders, how much you're trying to grow your company in a macro that's only growing 1%. So I think I think people have to think about what the growth model looks like from an investor perspective and access to capital. And certainly, and the banks have been burned through this process. So I think, there ought to be rationally better acting investment returning that I think makes it a little bit slower to return, which then, has to inform your view of what mid-cycle prices, what supply is going to be to balance the demand going forward. So one, shale's not broke, shale's not gone, shale will come back. But I do think it comes back slower because there's going to be pressure on companies to confine their capital program, maybe not grow as dramatically as they were before, because I don't think the access to capital in the investor community, at least in the public side of the business, is going to be as robust as it was over the last decade. And that's just a value proposition conversation about how do we get value investors and energy investors back into this business? And that's going to be a function of giving money back to the investor, modifying your growth so you don't have to grow that fast, and a real heavy focus on returns and return on capital employed. That's what's going to get the investors back excited again about the E&P space.
Well, I guess I think you all saw that pretty early, well before this, and started on focusing on return to shareholders. Probably 2 or 3 years ago. How did that evolve?
Well, we came through the last downturn, if you recall, that fateful Thanksgiving Day in 2014. When OPEC made the decision to go back after market share, the cause of that downturn in 15 and 16, we did a lot to the company in terms of re-identifying the portfolio that we thought could exist in what we felt like was going to be a lower mid-cycle price with a lot of volatility, given the short cycle nature of the shale. And we saw that shale production coming. We affectionately referred to that a number of years ago as a tidal wave scenario we had in our planning. And it just informed our view that we really had to rethink the whole value proposition associated with E&P companies. And we did that back in 2016 and basically said, you've got to give a fair amount back to the shareholder. In our case, it's greater than 30% of our cash returned back to the shareholder. You want to do that in a fixed and a variable way. So through a dividend channel, and we did it, the variable way through buying some of our shares back. But more importantly, grow your company on 70% of the cash flow, grow it modestly, and a real hyper-focus on cost, low cost of supply, and really generating competitive returns, not only in the E&P industry, but into the broader S&P 500 or the industrial space. That's how, with that kind of continued improvement and continued competitive forces inside the company, we thought, the only way we're going to bring investors back to the E&P space. You just can't go through this value destruction and hope to keep investors, which is why the share of energy has dropped so dramatically in the S&P 500. Not only are the tech stocks doing well, but energy's missed that because investors have fled and don't believe the value proposition is executable.
What this did by doing it when you did it has given you a relative resilience compared to other companies.
Yeah, certainly. And that's why coming into this particular downturn, we had such strength and relative strength vis-a-vis our peers with the balance sheet and putting cash on the balance sheet like we did. And we could have distributed all that. We felt like we wanted to have cash on the balance sheet because we don't hedge our production. So we know we're going to go through these cycles and we have to have the wherewithal to keep our programs consistent. We haven't done layoffs inside our company. We've tried to hold the productive capacity of the company intact, and we've been doing that on the back of our balance sheet, the strength of that balance sheet, because we want to come back into the next upturn, which we know is coming. We know it will happen as demand recovers. We wanted to preserve that productive capacity of the company. So we were able to do things because of where we set the company up 3 or 4 years ago through the portfolio rationalization that we've done, through the lowering of the cost of supply, hyper-focus on returns, and really, really satisfying our own investment opportunities on 70% of our cash flow and returning a fair amount back to the shareholder.
Right. So can you characterize what your dialogue with shareholders is like now?
Well,
That's
I think
going to change.
Yeah, you know, it has changed. I think they recognize what we've done in the company. And I think they recognize as well that it is the right value proposition for a very volatile kind of commodity price world. And that you have to have a very strong balance sheet. You have to have a great asset base at low cost of supply. The ESG, the transition discussion, is not going away. You know, the world needs to transition to lower carbon fuels over time. But even there, there's space for oil and gas, because it's so important for cheap, reliable energy in all four corners of the world. So I think against that backdrop, they also see that it's a rational decision to say, you know, you need to keep the shareholder. You just can't go grow and spend 120% of your cash flow continuing to grow. That's not going to be a model that gets rewarded over time. That's our belief. That's what we hear a lot from our shareholders, you know, and I guess time will tell. There's always room for quality companies that are growing in this business, but I don't think, given the maturity of the business, the growth in the macro combined with all the other issues that we're having to deal with from a transitional perspective, that's the right model for, I think, is the right model for companies going forward.
So you really, I mean, defined a new social contract with investors. Do you see the industry, others, I mean, are having to follow in that same direction? There's not much choice, is there?
Well, I don't, in my opinion, there's not much choice, Dan. I think it has to happen. I think we're starting to see some of that. You know, we're seeing companies just not outspending their cash flows by, you know, 120, 130%, and then relying on the equity markets to raise the capital or the debt markets to go fund that sort of thing. So the first sort of change in behavior is people living within their means. And even those companies now are starting to give a little bit back through the dividend channel, or do some of those return to shareholder, more shareholder-friendly activities that we think are important to bring the investors back into business. So yes, we've seen the start of that, but it does take a unique portfolio. The challenge is, in a pure play unconventional player, you know, that is fighting pretty high first year declines and high capital intensity, right, you know, to kind of keep that up. It does take a bit more, we believe, a bit more diversified portfolio to be able to do what we're doing.
Well, let me go to the diversified portfolio. I want to go to Alaska in a second, but before that, just to go back to shale. I know you think of scenarios and would want to make a prediction, but if we were at 13 million barrels a day, do you have any expectation, with this incredible drop in activity, what that means in terms of where the U.S. will be as a producer, you know, a year from now?
Yeah, it's really, really hard to say, Dan, whether how much capital will be available, what the, you know, what the trajectory of the recovery is, how much cash flow companies are going to have to reinvest. I think it's a longer road back to above 10 million a day or so where we're at today. I would probably, if I was a betting man today, it'd be pretty difficult for us to return to 13 million barrels a day. But we'll get back above 10, back above 11, maybe encroaching on 12 as we go through. But a lot of that depends on the shape of this recovery. And it'd be a great question that I would ask you. I'd be love to get your perspective. Do you think we're going back to a million barrels a day of demand?
No.
Because I think a lot of that's going to be one of the pieces of the equation that dictate how fast this recovery is. So are we going back to 100 million barrels a day, and does that really set a mid-cycle price that allows shale to return?
It's very hard to see that because, as you say, the source of capital that's necessary for that isn't going to be there. So our expectation in January, before this all happened, was you know, that the U.S. would grow by maybe 300,000 or 400,000 barrels a day. And now, you know, I think we see pretty substantial decline down to maybe 10 million barrels a day by July of next year, 9.5, 10, but then starting to build up again as we start to have growth. I think that's a reasonable hypothesis, given what's happened to the industry and to the markets and people's access to capital. But that does get to another question. Are you concerned about whether the service, we'll have a service industry there to?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I think they've always been there for us. And I think it's a pretty fractionated industry as well. I think you would expect to see some consolidation. Certainly the returns in the service industry have been hurt over the course of the last couple of downturns. and there may not be a lot left to absorb back into the companies. There are a lot more costs they can take out of their system. I think they are looking at some new technologies and some rational ways to work with the operators to continue to reduce the cost of that service. But it does feel like there's not a lot more left to give. And they furloughed a lot of workers as we've gone from, you know, the rig count down to where the rig count is today. And more importantly, the frac crews are, you know, the frac spreads are down to like 40 when they were well over 200 a while back ago. So that's why I think this recovery takes a little bit of a while when you look at the full integrated system and workers returning back to work if we get some price signals that would allow the capital to come back into play. So we'd hope that by the fourth quarter or the early part of next year, you would see some activity picking back up. And the first of that's going to come in the pressure pumping side of the business. And then slowly the rigs will get added as well.
So you mentioned, of course, diversified, and you spent part of your earlier career in Alaska. And in recent years, I know from our conversations at CERAWeek and what you've been doing that you have seen new potential in Alaska. But I think there are now some concerns there about the above ground risk.
Yeah, so it's been a big part of our company for a long time. So through our heritage companies, we, you know, discovered oil on the North Slope back in the late 60s, and we've been a part of that for now over 50 years. And we faced a decision maybe 4 or 5 years ago looking at Alaska saying, is it really going to be a competitive basin inside the company going forward? We had some exploration ideas. You know, the state did some pretty dramatic things to improve the competitiveness of the basin by lowering some of the severance taxes, and that did spur more investment and more opportunity. We went out and did some exploration at the western side of the North Slope, and we found some new petroleum systems, some new upside that resulted in our what we call our Willow discovery and our Narwhal discovery over by the Alpine Field in the western North Slope. So there's the opportunity for Alaska to go through another renaissance. We've now been able to stabilize the production that's going through TAPS, roughly 500,000 barrels a day. Remember at peak, it was over 2 million barrels a day coming down TAPS. So we see a lot of new opportunities sitting in Alaska with some of the exploration success that we've had. We've done some acquisition to take our partners out so we can control what we're doing up in Alaska. So now we effectively own our position at 100%. And we're excited about some of the exploration opportunities. Now, you referred the above ground risk, and there is a citizens initiative that's going on right now in Alaska that will probably come to
Shouldn't we say some citizens initiative?
Some citizens.
Not all citizens.
Yeah, not all. I think they're wanting or proposing to raise taxes on the industry. We obviously think that's the wrong thing to be doing because it'll cut growth, it'll cut opportunity, it'll reduce the amount of investment that's going in long term. And this really is a long term decision. Alaska is it's a high cost area. It takes a long time to develop the resources. So you have to be thinking about Alaska in the very long term. There may be some short term gain that you can make, but it definitely is at the pain for the long term in Alaska. So, you know, we're citizens are smart. They understand that. The government understands it. So I think we're having those conversations with the citizens of Alaska, and we hope to defeat the initiative in November, but we'll see what happens, and certainly we'll change our plans accordingly if it works. But it's not a huge impact either. It's a manageable impact, but it's not something that we should be doing.
Right, but it will affect how capital gets allocated.
It absolutely affects how people think about Alaska, how capital gets reinvested into the state, and what the long-term prospects of growth or flattening or, you know, keeping TAPS throughput at a constant kind of level.
So I heard you a few minutes ago use that word consolidation, and what you're thinking about, consolidators or I don't know what the noun would, somebody who gets consolidated, but how you see it working out.
I think the fundamental part is we got to put these assets into less hands, more rational hands that will run them for returns, not necessarily for growth's sake. And doing that then cuts the fixed cost of the system, brings the cost of supply down, and makes just the U.S. Energy system and the global energy system more competitive with a lot of the NOCs and the other people that are competing in this business.
But as you say, it's harder to do it in a low price.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's sometimes hard to transact at high prices and hard to transact at low prices for different reasons. So maybe it's easier on the slope, either up or down. Should I do that? But I think there has to be some rational conversation amongst boards and managements. It's what's the right value proposition going forward for this business, and how do we participate, you know, with companies that can kind of, that can offer that kind of a value proposition.
Right.
I think those are important conversations that people need to have, because I think that's how we're going to get more investors back into the business, and that's how we're going to show good returns, which is paramount to trying to increase the valuation of your company.
Right. So let me just ask you one or two more questions. You know, from government, have you seen things that have been supportive and helpful, things that are not helpful, what you're concerned about?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. Certainly, many of the countries that rely a lot on oil and gas revenues are trying to figure out what this means for them going forward. Some are putting incentives in place to incentivize more investment, and some are wanting a bigger slice of the pie. So it does depend on where you're at around the world to decide that. We just talked about Alaska. Hopefully they'll be rational in terms of how they think about that. And then certainly the political situation going here forward in the United States. Don't know what happens come November. We have a big important election in our country as well. So yeah, this kind of volatility is not good
right. For
the above ground risk. You know, we already deal with subsurface risk, and we're having to deal with above ground risk that looks different around the world depending on where countries are at. You just saw Argentina is thinking about ways to incentivize more Vaca Muerta production and more investment coming into there. You know, contrast that with some of the other areas that are thinking about raising taxes and making it, you know, harder for oil and gas production in their country. So it's a broad mix.
Are there things you'd like to, either that you've seen from the federal government that have been helpful, or things you'd like to see that would be helpful?
From our federal government?
Yeah.
I think the, you know, people react to some of the regulatory streamlining that's been done by this administration, and some react in a positive, some react in a very negative way. But I say it was really, really important to the revolution and the increasing reserves and the production coming out of the U.S. that makes us more, you know, energy secure as a nation. And that was real, real important, you know, and I think a lot of that was done not trying to lower the floor. What I talk about is, you know, we're trying to raise the floor in terms of how we produce and the sustainability of our business going forward. You know, we're about trying to reduce the methane emissions. We don't need regulations to do it, because companies are voluntarily doing it today. We're trying to reduce the fugitive emissions. We're trying to reduce flaring and get that down. And the CO2 footprint has come down in the United States, despite the fact that we've seen this dramatic growth in oil and gas production over time. So the companies are trying to do the right thing and trying to manage through this transition and improve the sustainability of the product we have. We're going after our scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. Our company alone has taken 7 million tons of equivalent CO2 out of our business over the last 5 to 6 years. And we're trying to address the scope 2 emissions. And as a company, we've joined the Climate Leadership Council and support a tax on carbon as a means to address scope 3 emissions from the products out of the material that we produce today. So I think we're trying to be reasonable, trying to be good actors, but also trying to deliver that, you know, affordable and sustainable energy to all four corners of the world.
Do you, I mean, as we head into a campaign, why do you think that message is hard to communicate to, as, you know, part of the public?
Well, I think it's just recognition of the polarization that exists not only in the United States today, but globally as well. It seems to be a conversation about all or nothing. And there's no reasonable conversations going down the middle that say we can have these kinds of jobs, this incredible industry that's creating the security for our country. We can do that sustainably with the climate in mind, with the planet in mind. And so we avoid going through this, you know, huge experiment with our planet over the next 30, 40 years, which I think we all agree we don't want to go through that experiment. So I think there are middle ground here. And unfortunately today, no one wants to sort of occupy that middle ground, unfortunately. But hopefully we'll get forced into that, because that's the right place to be, that gets rational decisions and rational thought coming out of it.
So, Ryan, as a last question, it's been an amazing 6 months. We started off at $63 a barrel, collapsed completely, come back maybe faster than people thought. There's still a lot of uncertainties about GDP, the virus, and everything else, U.S.-China relations. What's your message to your own team in terms of dealing with this whiplash that you've gone through?
No, it's a great question. Well, what we talk about is just consistency of purpose, you know, and delivering on the, don't keep the long term in mind. We've been preaching volatility, you know, in our company for the last 5 to 6 years, and we can't control a lot of what's going on around us, but we can sort of focus on what's important to the company. And that's, you know, being safe, protecting the environment, being inclusive, being diverse, being collaborative, and doing the things that we do, and being low cost and delivering the returns that are important to the investor community, and just differentiating our company in that sort of light. And there's going to be this stuff going on around us that we can't control. So it really is a focus on the things we can control, and focus on being a good citizen to all of our stakeholders, wherever we're at, you know, wherever we have our operations around the world, and what we're doing here corporately at the center as well. And that's really, really been the message. I put out a note to our workforce along the lines of what the BRT established when we saw, you know, Mr. Floyd's terrible, terrible tragedy there. And I think that's important. Business has to step up and be a voice and manage through the discrimination that exists in the United States today. And that's a lot of stuff going on around us, but, you know, we also need to focus on the business at hand and what we do really well as an industry and as a company.
Right. Well, Ryan, thank you very much for this really great and very comprehensive conversation. We touched on a lot of things, and I'm really appreciative.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, and hope everybody at IHA stays safe and healthy as well.
Thank you. I've been talking with Ryan Lance, who's the chairman and CEO of ConocoPhillips. Thank you all for joining us for this CERAWeek conversation.